I realized that I forgot which of these. So one of these is, so this one, right? This tab is the tab for this conference, as you guys might all recognize. This one is for continuous waves. It's a continuous wave paper. And so I just thought it was funny. It was very fitting that, you know, in the end, we're all doing the same thing. So the structure of this talk, I'm going to briefly discuss what are directed and targeted searches. Where do we look? What do we look at in particular? And how, I'm going to sketch out a couple of ideas for how we might run a directed search for boson clouds. So as was described before, we kind of split our searches up into three different types. We have our all-sky searches, where you don't really assume anything about where the source is. Where you don't assume anything about where the search is. You have our directed searches. So there's a little bit of LIGO jargon here, right? We have directed and targeted searches. So you can just think of it as directed searches. You know the direction in the sky to look. And a targeted search, you know exactly all of the parameters of the source. And so I'm going to be focusing on these two, where for a directed search, as we've heard, you pick a source with a known sky position where you don't know or you don't really know how fast it's spinning, for instance. For a targeted search, you pick a source with a full ephemeris. So these are going to be pulsars where you know exactly what's going on with its spin frequency.
And when you say no sky positions, that means like optically, so it's really...
Yes, very well known, basically. Yeah. Depends on the search. Some searches require more, angular resolution.
But could it be that one of these is, for example, have you tried to look at the position in the sky of a recent black hole merger or something? Would that qualify as directed search, or is it too big to qualify the region that you currently constrain in the sky from mergers?
Yeah.
It's too big to qualify for a directed search.
Black hole merger is definitely too big. The neutron star merger, that was fine, but that's because we had optical observations there. Right? So our sources, right? Here's a nice cartoon. Our sources in general, the most promising ones historically have either been isolated neutron stars with bumps. I know we're supposed to do bulges, but I like the little mountain up here. You could also have a neutron star, a bumpy neutron star in a binary orbit around with some kind of companion. Maybe it's just hanging out in that orbit, or maybe that companion is accreting onto that neutron star and causing some change in its shape. So with all sky searches, everyone is an expert now on exactly what goes into an all sky search. So what you might do is, you know, you look across the whole sky and you might search over frequency and spin down, for instance. When you go to a directed search, you know the direction of the sky, you know the direction you want to look in. So you only have one sky position that you search over. So now you kind of free up your computational resources now to do some searches in, for instance, the second derivative second frequency derivative for isolated neutron stars. And we'll discuss, and Keith also mentioned this before, about why that generally is necessary for the objects that we do searches for, directed searches for. You can also accommodate orbital modulation for neutron stars in binaries. And like was mentioned, we do have all sky computationally reasonable all sky searches for binaries, but it's a lot harder to do that. Targeted searches, you know exactly where to look. You have your ephemeris from electromagnetic pulsations, so you only really need to search a single set of parameters. And in this case, you treat isolated sources or sources in binaries the same way, because in either case, you know exactly how, or more or less, you know how you expect the signal to be modulated based on where it is and, you know, how fast it's rotating and all that sort of thing. And as was mentioned, we also have a little tweak on targeted searches. We have these narrowband searches where either for practical reasons, like maybe your ephemeris is out of date, or, you know, for physical, you have some sort of physical motivation for not wanting to say that the electromagnetic and gravitational wave parameters match exactly. You want to give that a little bit more leeway. So you can do then a narrowband search. So in general, when we decide what sources to search for, our main consideration, besides obviously could we detect something, but, you know, being in the CW group for a couple of years, you quickly learn that that's, you know, a little bit, it's not the best thing to hope for, I guess. More so, what we focus on is, could we see something interesting? And by interesting, I mean, what we can do is we can compare our estimated direct upper limits on gravitational wave emission, And we compare that to indirect upper limits from energy conservation arguments. So we say, okay, well, at most, this much energy was emitted. This much energy has been lost by this object that's spinning down, for instance. And if all of that was emitted in gravitational waves, that is our maximum. Realistically, it's going to be a fraction of that. So we could have, if you know exactly how fast the object is spinning down, you could set, you could go directly to set a spin down limit. And again, you know, this is basically saying that your change in kinetic energy over here is just going to be the change essentially, or it's just going to be defined, described by this over here, where all you have, this works for a targeted search, you know what the frequency is, you know what the spin down is, you can set that limit there. If you don't know what the measured spin down, if you don't know what the spin down is, you can still set an age-based limit by saying, well, okay, let's say the frequency changes as a function of the, the frequency changes as a function of f to the n, frequency to the n. And for gravitational wave emission, for mass quadrupole emission, you would set n to be 2. For things like accreting neutron stars and binaries, in this case, there's the neutron star, there's the binary. The binary is, there's a neutron star, there's a companion. The companion goes, the neutron star accretes mass from the companion, and then that causes it to develop some sort of asymmetry, maybe. It's been observed that, for instance, low-mass X-ray binaries, like normally you would expect that a neutron star, in this case, could be spun up to some sort of arbitrarily high frequency up until the point that it, you know, becomes unstable and starts to break up, maybe. But in general, we've observed these neutron stars, these pulsars, to their spin frequencies to lie in a small range, suggesting that there's something that maybe is causing it to stop spinning up, or causing it to basically that there's something that's balancing out the angular momentum you might gain from accretion. And in this case, we assume that it's going to be gravitational wave emission.
Can I ask, is it possible that you see this spinning star because of this spin up?
Because of accretion,
you accrete the angular momentum, but you don't lose it efficiently to gravitational waves or whatever the other mechanisms. So if you observe this type of accreting system, then you would see it may be possible to see it spin up.
Yes, and I'm not sure exactly, do the searches look for spin any kind of f dot in the binary searches in particular?
Not the source, no. Yeah. It's basically assuming the torque
balance.
The m dot would have to be huge to
change f dot by
it's quite a significant amount.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not realistic to observe.
Normally the gravitational wave plot would be very efficient as a function of f. So it would be very efficient in sort of
getting rid of the x dot.
Okay, so all right, so we discussed the fact that we do targeted searches for known pulsars. There's a lot of pulsars out there, so we have to ask ourselves then which of the pulsars are going to be good targets. So here we have a plot, a PP dot plot. So here we have the period, the spin period of the pulsar, and here we have the derivative of the spin period of the pulsar. LIGO cares about, or can observe basically, pulsars in this sort of range here. The pulsar population basically splits into two. There's this big group up here for these standard pulsars, and then there's a group down here that are the millisecond pulsars. In general, let's say you have simplest system. Let's say you have an isolated pulsar. It forms. You expect it to be bumpiest, highest ellipticity when it's young, and then you expect it to slowly smooth out as it ages. You also expect it then to be spinning fastest when it's young and then to spin more slowly as it ages. But then you start to notice these things like, well, the fastest spinning pulsars are actually these ones down here that don't seem to be, they're spinning very fast. They don't seem to be, the spin doesn't seem to be changing very much. So these millisecond pulsars are basically pulsars in binaries, are going to be pulsars in binaries where they've been spun up by their companions. So in general, here, so because I'm a data analyst, I care about things like G and C, so I apologize for all these extra factors out here. Let's see. Yeah, so here on this plot, there are these diagonal lines here that say, you know, 10 to 5 years, 10 to the 6 years. These are sort of estimated characteristic ages that have been they're calculated assuming that your evolution here, because it's a pulsar, has been dominated by magnetic dipole emission. So that's just sort of an ballpark estimate with some assumptions about how old your sources might be. And we already saw what the ellipticity here is. So when we care about, when we want to find a promising source, we want a source that might have a larger strain. You can get a larger strain by having a larger ellipticity. Obviously, you can have, you want things that are closer. Looking at this, right, there's this F squared here term, which would be great, except that the faster spinning objects are also in general going to be the older ones, the more symmetric ones. And so that kind of offsets that that benefit there. So just kind of going through real quick. So initial LIGO, we started out with our first targeted search with 28 pulsars, went up to 78 pulsars in later science runs, 116 pulsars. Adding Virgo really helped with this low frequency region in initial LIGO, initial Virgo. And then in O1, as we saw, we are up to 200 pulsars. And out of these 200 pulsars, 78 were searched for the first time. This plot we've seen before. Out of these 200 pulsars, there are also the 11 high priority pulsars. These are the ones where basically we thought we could get close to or surpass the spin down limit. And in this plot, the red circles or the orange circles mark the pulsars for which we did beat the spin down limit. And here we see Crab, where we know that the fraction of energy emitted in gravitational waves is less than 1%, the total energy lost. Yeah. And then in the Crab, the fraction is less than 0.2%.
So,
yeah.
Going back really quickly, you said that you expect that when the neutron star is born, it'll be bumpiest and then it settles over time. And I guess that makes sense. But also, if it's accreting from a companion, don't you expect that to sort of have these sort of mounds of accretion deposition that'll settle over time?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was being a little bit kind of zeroth order, kind of hand-wavy there. Yes.
But I guess is there a theoretical expectation for which one wins in terms of being bumpier on the whole?
I don't know. Do you have a good sense for this?
If we knew the answer to that, we'd be happy. We keep our eyes wide open, so we look for both, but we really don't know. There have been some attempts to do pretty detailed calculations of what happens in an LNXB and what happens to that matter when it decreases down. And the prejudice is it dissipates through the surface, disperses relatively quickly. Even in very strong magnetic fields, you don't have as much confinement as you would like to keep you, say, you don't have the magnetic pole.
Also, these pulsars are not tightly locked, so it's not a material is raining in a very preferred region of the star.
Okay, so using the this formula that we expect for, or this formula for the expected strain based on some sort of ellipticity and some sort of distance and frequency, you can then translate the strain or the upper limits, the constraints on strain, into some sort of constraints on ellipticity. And that's what's done here, where ellipticity is on the vertical axis here and the gravitational wave frequency on the horizontal axis. Here are also, again, lines of constants, characteristic age.
But there is no function here because it looks like the ellipticity is dropping linearly with age, with the age of the system. So there is no function. These are the purple lines that you drew are just set by the expectations for the pulsars. They have no correlation with epsilon.
I believe so, yes. Yeah, so as we see, so as Keith mentioned before, we have our most stringent limit on ellipticity over here. For this pulsar, so that you have these older pulsars down here, and therefore it's reasonable that you would have sort of these very strict limits on how asymmetric that pulsar actually is. On the other hand, all of our sort of high priority targets, the ones that we could surpass or might be able to surpass spin down limit, are up here in this area. And so those pulsars basically correspond to sort of ones that are up here in this area. So moving on to narrowband searches, as was discussed, these are ones that allow some sort of mismatch between your electromagnetic gravitational wave parameters. Just want to show, a recent result where they took those 11 pulsars, We took those 11 high priority pulsars where we could beat or approach a spin down limit. And you get sort of, you know, you get sort of constraints that are less constraining than, you know, the targeted search reasonably, but you sort of allow for slightly different, you allow for, you know, you have more flexibility in what you're looking for. Going back then to this plot of what promising sources are. So when we talk about promising sources for directed searches, we're here, we don't know what the ephemeris is, right? So now I'm assuming that neutron stars, the neutron star population sort of acts like this kind of pulsar population, this pulsar population in general.
I guess that's what you're saying, what these are now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so when we care, so if we don't have a pulsar, we don't have pulsations. So it's a little bit harder, or it's a lot harder, right? Because we don't know exactly what frequency it's at. We don't know what spin down it's at, that sort of thing. So for a directed search, then, we still have this formula that tells us how strong we expect the gravitational wave emission to be, or could be. So the promising objects, then, are going to be young, because they're going to, in zeroth order, they're going to be, be more asymmetric. Accreting objects, because then you could have accretion-driven asymmetries. You want these sources to be nearby. And as we've heard before, you also sometimes, instead of doing a search on a single around a single object, you could search a region of high density or high stellar density. The expectation being then you look at one place, and instead of looking for one source, you could find a whole, you know, you maybe you're looking at a whole bunch of sources. So one of our favorite targets for directed searches are supernova remnants, and in particular, the supernova remnant Cassiopeia A or Cassa. Because this is one of the youngest supernova remnants. Because it's so young, though, the flip side of that is the frequency is changing pretty quickly, and so we do have to go to second order in frequency derivative. There are searches for Cassa that were done using initial LIGO. There are some searches that are ongoing or that are forthcoming using advanced detector data.
Do we know the frequency do we know that there's a neutron star there, first of all?
There's some arguments based on, arguments based on, I think, the temperature that was measured. The idea being that the temperature was too high to be explained by a black hole, that you needed something happening on some sort of matter surface. And
we don't see pulsing.
Correct, we do not see pulsations, yeah. So that makes life a lot harder. So as we saw before, right, we have strain, we take our upper limits on strain, we convert them into upper limits on ellipticity, right? So we do that with directed searches as well. And what we do here is, what we do for a directed search is we say, okay, well, we don't know what frequency it's spinning at. But what we can tell you is if it is spinning at a certain frequency, or, you know, if it is emitting gravitational waves at this frequency, it could not be more asymmetric than this amount, than this value over here, otherwise we would have seen something. So we start to do these same sort of exclusion regions for ellipticity for individual sources this way.
Can I ask you, yeah. Okay, why is there a max epsilon?
Yeah, this is because, this is because in our searches, we can't go to arbitrarily high spin downs, for instance. So we go to a maximum spin down that we think would be physically possible for an object of this age. And that's represented by this line. So this is assuming, I believe this is the spin down limit, assuming that all of the emission, again, is in gravitational waves, yeah.
If there is a magnetic field, does that change things?
Absolutely. It absolutely does. But this is without knowing, you know, we wouldn't be as constraining in that case. And a short plug. So mentioned before, this was a search performed on Einstein at Home, which is a volunteer distributed computing network system search. What we do basically is we have all these volunteers sign up, and you guys can sign up. And that's something we would like you to do, because searches are expensive and searches only work if we have computers to search them on. So what we do is we divide our whole search parameter space into little, let's say, 8-hour chunks, basically in these work units. So in each work unit takes about 8 hours to run on a standard computer. We send those out to the volunteers. They do the searches. They send the information back to us, and then we have search results to analyze. So if you can, this would be great if you would want to sign up for Einstein at Home. There are also teams. You can create a Perimeter Institute team. There might already be a Perimeter Institute team. And it, yeah, I mean, what matters, right, is, you know, all of these competitions based on absolutely
so if
useless things.
Super Agents, you all have to sign up.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, and the other thing is, yeah, the other thing is, you know, if you don't, you know, if continuous waves aren't your thing, we also, Einstein at Home also does searches, blind searches for gamma ray pulsars. So we do a lot of, Einstein at Home does a bunch of different things, but you all should care about continuous waves. Going back to science now. So instead of looking at one single source, like a single supernova remnant, we could also search a region that's densely populated, like the galactic center, where, depending on who you ask, there could be thousands of isolated, or thousands of neutron stars within a small region. So we do these same things where we say, okay, what are our upper limits on strain? We could have detected strain. We could have detected any strain that was higher than this. Obviously, we didn't, so we have an upper limit on the strain. We convert those to upper limits on ellipticity and also on R-mode amplitude, if we want to do that.
The angle?
Sorry?
How big is the angle that you observe of the bulge? What distance of the bulge?
This one, I don't remember off the top of my head, unfortunately. Let's see. Yeah, no. Sorry. Yeah, okay. So what I want to say here is, all right, going back to this plot of promising sources. So I've highlighted the binaries in orange here, the sources that we know are associated with supernova remnants up here. There are also these sources, these purple sources, that are in globular clusters. I know you might say, all right, well, globular clusters, I mean, these all look pretty old, right? And so in general, neutron stars in binary in globular clusters are pretty old. Why would you search there? Well, you can have globular clusters that have very dense environments. So if they have very dense environments, you could get things like accretion or other sort of interactions that you normally wouldn't get if it were just hanging out by itself. And then it might be worth looking at a source like this. And so then you can do the same sort of things where you take your upper limits on strain, convert them to upper limits on ellipticity, R-mode amplitude, that sort of thing. Briefly going into binary, so we discussed the fact that, all right, for binaries, what we compare our upper limits to is sort of this torque balance limit, where you assume that the angular momentum that you gain from accretion over here is balanced by the angular momentum that you lose, or that is emitted by gravitational wave emission. But the question is, you know, you don't have a good handle on these amounts. So what you can do instead is you look at, the source. So you have companion object accreting onto the neutron star in this case, and that releases an X-ray emission. And you can say that, all right, well, the sources that are brighter, have brighter X-ray flux, these are the ones that are going to have higher mass transfer, right? So in that case, these are the ones that are going to be good for sources with higher X-ray flux, going to be more mass accreted. If more mass is accreted, then you can get more out of gravitational waves, roughly speaking. And so that leads you to SCOEX1, which is the brightest low mass X-ray binary and persistent X-ray flux. And this is the source that we look at in general for our binary-directed searches. Searches, again, have been done in initial LIGO, advanced LIGO as well. This is the most recent published set of upper limits that were done, performed using advanced LIGO, where you have here the comparison of three different search methods with different trade-offs and different sort of strengths. In comparison to what you have here, the torque balance. So each time, you know, we hope to get better and better down here.
So that one you don't have any information about what frequency you expect?
Yeah. So for this source, we don't know what that neutron star, which is the source that we care about, we don't know what frequency it's spinning at. We do know some of the, like Keith was saying, we do know a lot of the binary orbit parameters, but we don't know the gravitational wave frequency.
Do you specifically search all the Z sources, or just is SCOEX1 sort of specifically singled out?
SCOEX1, as far as, is basically specifically singled out. It's just the most promising source for this. Do you have anything more to add to that, or?
Yeah, it's right, the source.
Yeah.
By far.
Yeah.
So you can look at the other sources, see how promising they are, and this one is the most promising.
The search methods have some rapid development, so it's convenient to make your search on something that's been searched already and shows that you have better results. It's just to concentrate that.
Yeah. Really, this is the most promising because just the accretion rate, if you sort of say that is what is causing the flux, if the brightest one has got the most accretion.
Well, it's incredibly close, but all of the Z sources are essentially Eddington limited neutron stars. So they're all very bright. There's just a handful of them. I think it's six. But SCOEX one is the closest, the brightest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no theoretical reason why we couldn't, but limitations on manned search, person power, and computational time and stuff like that, SCOEX one is the way to go for now. So I'm just going to sort of briefly sketch out some ideas for if we wanted to do directed searches, or if you all wanted to do directed searches for boson clouds. I should say I kind of have a zeroth order understanding of the emission that we would expect, so I hope you can tell me more things that I should be worried about or considering. So in general, what I've tried to show is that for our CW searches, for our directed searches, we take our constraints on strain, our upper limits on the strain, and we turn those into constraints on source properties, right? So in this case, usually we turn them into constraints on ellipticity of the source. We could do the same thing. There's no reason why we couldn't really do the same thing for boson clouds. So comparing a directed search, why would you want to do a directed search versus an all-sky search? Trivially, I mean, a directed search, you know, you can get better sensitivity, but also for a directed search, you can know a black hole is there, I guess, and you sort of take out, you don't have to do the sort of population arguments and things like that. The cons, and I don't know how much this matters, but you're limited, right? You're only looking at one object, so you would be limited in how much of the parameter space you can probe. You can always tweak knobs to say, well, we might not have expected this anyway. It's unclear, for instance, if your source has had time to develop the boson cloud and then to have this emission.
That depends on the age. It's not a it depends on how far it is,
yeah.
What parameter space. But there, as you said, I mean, there is perhaps some of Jack's objects are good candidates. So, there's part of the parameter space where it could have developed cloud period. The question is that good part of the parameter space to give you a signal.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing, again, to keep in mind is that, you know, with the all-sky searches, right, we have all-sky searches, you know, it's the question, again, of do we sort of reinterpret results we already have, or do we actually spend time and, you know, effort working on new sources? So right now I'm just going to speculate a little bit on what our potential targets we could do for directed searches. For boson clouds, we've already discussed the LIGO-Virgo binary merge and remnants. I forgot about this. The problem is, right, for the binary black hole coalescences, right, what you would have left, you wouldn't really have a good handle on where that is in the sky. So I guess that doesn't really work.
I'm just wondering, how does the time it takes you to do your search, scale with the sky localization, proportional to the area of the sky, or basically you can't do it unless you know it very precisely? Or?
You can do it. I mean, different searches, this, you know, as you go, if your source is right there and you sort of end up looking a little bit over here, I mean, your sensitivity drops fairly quickly. Depends on the search. What you can also do is if you don't know exactly where the source is, but you have kind of a small region, you could do a multi-directed search, let's say. And you could do a directed search in a couple of different places. So that's the sort of thing you might do if you wanted to focus on a directed search. But, you know, with the binary black holes, what, you have hundreds of square degrees? I don't know exactly the number.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it'll start getting better now that Virgo's online. And maybe in the future, especially once you have multi-detector arrays, that would be very exciting when you can really pinpoint things. Or if you have optical counterparts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so one thing that's been brought up is that it really helps, right, to have optical counterparts or to have some sort of electromagnetic counterparts. We have these for, I mean, gamma ray bursts, right? So one thing that I haven't heard, and I don't know if it's because it's not a reasonable thing to look at, but you have a gamma ray burst. The central engine is going to be either a black hole or a neutron star. If you have a central engine that's a black hole, so I say X gamma ray burst central engines because gamma ray bursts are transient events. After it's done bursting, you still have a black hole there. If you start out with a black hole, the black hole is still there. So this might be something that might be worth looking into. The problem is these are generally at hundreds of megaparsecs. These are quite far away. And also the spin is, for the most part, no one's actually going, I don't know if there's a way to go and measure the spin of these gamma ray bursts. One thing I want to point out that you might say, well, wasn't there a gamma ray burst associated with the binary neutron star? Yes, but that was sort of a special case in that normally if we had a GRB that was that faint, we wouldn't have been able to convince anyone to look at it more closely to get the redshift, right? So there's a difficulty there. So most of the time when you get a GRB and you can actually pinpoint down how far away it is, it's going to be something that's, you know, hundreds of megaparsecs away at least. You can also look at the central objects of supernovae, and I'm saying this sort of in a weird way and not supernova remnants, right? Because it's slightly different. What I'm saying here is you observe an optical transient or some sort of transient that ends up being a supernova. You don't really care if there's a supernova remnant around it. It's not really, doesn't matter. But there's an object that's left at the center. That object could be a black hole. Depending on the type of supernova you have, you're more likely to get a black hole or a neutron star. And again, depending on the type of supernova, could be kiloparsecs away, could be megaparsecs away. Sort of notes up here. One thing I want to say is that before this conference, I didn't really take these seriously because I wasn't sure, you know, with the first glance, I thought we needed longer timescales for cloud formation, but I'm starting to hear that depending on the object, that might not be true. So these basically all require relatively short timescales for cloud formation. These are a couple years old. These are a couple decades old. These are, you know, maybe centuries old. I don't have a good sense. You guys are the ones to tell me whether that's actually reasonable or not to look at. So I already mentioned before that, you have the different types of GRBs. With respect to the spin, you might be able to, this is me hand waving, you might be able to infer the spin with arguments about the sustained emission. So the idea being that if you have a GRB and you're pretty sure there's a black hole with an accretion disk at the center that's powering the GRB, if your GRB lasts for a minute long, there's got to be something there there's got to be some extreme physics there, extreme case there, for instance, really fast spin that is sustaining that emission for that time scale. You might be able to infer its spin even just from the fact that you see a GRB in the first place. Because if you have, right, so I say up here, you know, some GRBs, long GRBs come from core collapses. Well, supernovae also come from core collapses. What's the difference between an object that creates a supernova with an object that creates a gamma ray burst? Unknown, but likely something to do with magnetic fields or really rapid spins, right? So if your progenitor object is spinning really rapidly and you require that in order to have a long GRB, then your black hole, zeroth order, should be spinning more rapidly as well. And also, central objects of supernovae, the spins are unknown, right? You can't really directly measure them, but there have been some attempts to do simulations to say what spins are reasonable. And I don't know if this is reasonable or not, but maybe you could do some sort of stacked analysis of these, right? Maybe one GRB isn't going to tell you a lot, or one supernova isn't going to tell you a lot. And, you know, we don't know the mass of these bosons that we're looking for, but they should be, you know, one, let's say one mass, right? They should be at one frequency, exactly, yeah. One frequency. And so in this case, you would expect, roughly speaking, the same ballpark signal from all of these sources that could produce that signal, right? And so maybe in this case, you could stack, you could do some sort of stacking analysis of the supernova or the GRBs to try to get out something from there.
And it doesn't matter that there is maybe a larger dot. I mean, one of the problems we have in this very large formation timescales for the cloud is that the frequency drift and the second derivative are probably important if you want to integrate for a long time.
Yeah.
So does that affect stacked analysis? I mean, I bet you'll get the heat in your coherence time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is just me. I speculating. I don't have a good answer for this.
Just to comment. Yeah, I mean, like for the time scales, I think the numbers that you're saying, like days to hundreds of years, are really excellent actually, because since these are at longer distances, you have to have more strongly coupled clouds to even hope to see them in the first place, which would mean that they would evolve faster.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like Mino was saying, they'd also have bigger frequency drifts and stuff.
Sure.
But,
and that's something to...
Yeah, it's reasonable. But they're all excellent candidates, but this is something to keep in mind. It comes together. Faster going clouds also have large frequencies, similar to young pulsars. So you have the same, some similar issues there. But
okay.
It's true that the signal will be coming in the bulk of one frequency.
Within
a few percent. Yeah.
What's the closest GRP sort
of
thing? Long or short?
Absolute closest one is, 1708-17, right?
Wow.
But besides that, I don't know in terms of megaparsecs. The redshifts are usually, the closest one, 0.001, I think? Something along those. Don't quote me on that, though. The internet can tell you better than I can right now. Most GRBs, though, you're going to get on redshift 1 in general. You might get some that are closer, 0.2, 0.3, but most GRBs are a little bit tricky with that. Something that's been mentioned before. You could also go to supermassive black holes where you get into the LISA regime, but it's worth thinking about now. And actually at the last LISA consortium, this came up, this type of emission came up as an idea, as a science case they might want to pursue. You could also look at supernova remnants with black holes. So this is slightly different from this because here, what I'm saying is you observe a supernova that happened in the last couple of decades. Here, I'm saying you observe a supernova remnant. So like what we have, one of our sources, one of our strong sources, or sources that we care about are supernova remnants where we think the central object is a neutron star. Why not take the opposite of that and look at supernova remnants where we think the central object is a black hole? In that case, you just have an isolated system that's sort of nice to work with. You can also have stellar mass black holes and electromagnetically detected binaries. So these low mass X-ray binaries are a subset of these, but there are other types of X-ray binaries that you could also look at. If you're like me, you don't really know off the top of your head where to go, so you go to Wikipedia to look for a list of supernova remnants, a list of black holes. You pick your source, maybe you go to Green's catalog to look at a list of supernova remnants, you start doing research there, you talk to your astronomer friends. So originally I had this list of known black holes, but now I've updated this to a very, very fancy list right here. So maybe you have a favorite source after you've done the calculations to see what source might be optimal. After that, you gotta pick your method, right? Because some methods are better than others. So traditionally, historically, most the directed searches for isolated stars or for isolated sources have been some sort of version of the F-statistic search that we've heard about before, but there are many other search pipelines that have been or could be applied to these searches, so there's no reason why we'd have to stick to these. There's a lot of different methods for searching for sources in binaries, and I tried to give sort of a very vague kind of high-level explanation of what these searches are, but I might have gotten some things wrong, so I would go to these go to the actual references to make sure to get a good handle on what these searches actually are. Some questions you might ask, and some of these have been discussed before. Main thing is, I guess, how much computational time you want to spend or how much we want to spend, I guess. How long do you expect the signal to be coherent? There's some searches that can go to very long coherent times. Some searches do better with short coherent times. So what do you care about? What parameter space are you interested in? That was brought up as well. Is your signal going to be affected by any other properties of the source? If you have accretion, you have accretion disk, you have a dense environment, is that going to mess things up? Are you going to need to consider any other parameters we currently don't consider that we haven't thought of? As far as the parameter space we're interested in, we've heard a lot about, we get back to, spin up, spin down a lot. If you want to do a zero spin up search, that's easy. If you want to do a non-zero spin up search, it's a little bit trickier, right? And then you have to do, there's some trade-offs as opposed, sensitivity versus how much you gain in, or sensitivity you gain versus computational costs you spend. We do Einstein at Home, for instance.
Do you have any idea how much the accretion can smear? Because it will be smearing, you're in a time, it's a time varying gravitational field, so it will smear the line. Do you guys have any idea from simulations or anything how much that should be?
For the first go at.
Neutron stars, for ordinary neutron stars, or for those ones that are the... So if you have a time-dependent accretion, that would smear the line. Whatever line is emitted by a neutron star would be smeared.
For example, X1, for example?
Yeah, for example. Do you have any...
Well, someone commented the accretion rate's pretty low, so the, you know, the mass dip deposition is at the level of 10 to the minus 7 to the minus 8 relative in a year. So it's a relatively
small smearing,
very small smearing due to rest mass changes. We worry more about fluctuations in the accretion.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about. Yeah, fluctuations so. in the gravitational field of the accretion disk, not that cause not changes in the frequency, but more, smear the signal as it is emitted from the neutron star.
Yeah. So in the initial LIGO era, we restricted the SCOEX-1 searches to 10 days coherence time because of the worry that went beyond 10 days. The Frege's resolution was getting too precise and we couldn't trust the signal would stay in that single band.
Yeah, yeah.
But now we have methods that can essentially string together multiple segments together. So our most recent searches can go beyond that limitation. We can tolerate a certain amount of wandering. In fact, we can tolerate what we think is astrophysically motivated.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess it would be very helpful. So we're gonna send you some, you know, time scales and strains and stuff. It would be very helpful if, I know we could find this in the papers, but if you just have a summary of how different searches scale as like the frequency drift or something, you know, like when you say we have to think about making trade-offs, like
let's quantify that. Yeah,
yeah,
that
because
bit,
for
yeah.
that's
helpful.
Important
yeah.
to tell you, okay,
yeah.
do this instead of that, and this
right.
is the parameter space that's yeah.
Sure.
If it matters, if I'm remembering this correctly, I think the usual mass of an accretion disk around one of these things is less than 10 to the 25 grams or something. So it's, you know, less than a piece in a million.
No, it's very small. The problem is that these guys, they're worried about frequency drifts of 10 to the minus 10 hertz per second or something. So even that tiny gravitational can, I mean, it's a much smaller fraction of the solar mass.
So
it's like 10 minus 8, 10 to minus 9 of the solar mass, but still, it's very
important. So it's something we have to worry about. We worry about it less than we used to because our ribs are more robust against it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and just brief thing before I finish. So we've sort of talked qualitatively the fact that, you know, we have to make some trade-offs with parameter space, how much we search versus, you know, sensitivity or versus computational cost. One thing we do in Einstein at Home now is we sort of quantify that. So we have a method where you give us a set of parameters or a set of priors to define some sort of detection probability across the parameter space you're interested in with a computational budget. What we can do is then we could determine the search setup that sort of maximizes the detection probability overall. And this is just a plot from a recent thing we did where we looked at a couple of different supernova remnants in the sky. And then we said, all right, well, depending on how much we want to spend, where should we be spending our search, right? Does it matter? Should we be looking at our youngest search? Our youngest object? Should we be looking at our closest object? So we can do that sort of thing. And this is just an example of one thing we do for Einstein at Home, but a lot of groups have this sort of...
Is unit dot in units of hertz per second? That's very large.
It's should be like, yeah, I don't know exactly. I think I might have, 10 to the negative 9 or something like
oh,
that, 10 to the negative 10.
That sounds more...
Yep, nope, sorry. Yep,
yeah.
That would be distressingly large. And I guess the thing I just want to end up on is that, you know, obviously besides all sky searches, we also perform directed and targeted searches. Again, directed search, you know where to look. Targeted search, you know where to look and exactly what parameters to look at. So we have a lot of analysis methods and pipelines to tackle both isolated and neutron stars and binaries. Each of these methods have their own strengths. So depending on what type of signal you might look at, you might want a different type of analysis method. Traditionally, our sources have been neutron stars, but there's no reason why we can't also run searches for boson clouds, except for, you know, computational costs, et cetera, right? But just kind of, you know, very high order speaking, you know, theoretically, there's no reason why we can't just modify our current searches to look for boson clouds.
Any more questions?
have you thought about going after the LIGO event, the neutron star merger?
We haven't. So I'm part of Einstein at Home. We ourselves haven't done that. There are many other search pipelines that are better for doing that sort of thing, just because for that type of signal, where you don't know exactly how the frequency evolves and that sort of thing, there are other searches that can do much better. We basically require searches where you know very well what the evolution is. Or fire sources.
Yes, thank you.
Sure. No, but I mean, there will be more binary neutron star mergers in the future, so this is why there's been a lot of interest is to sort of prepare these pipelines for the future. Yeah. Well, that was easy.
So let's take this period again.